in The Long View with Jonathan Friedland tomorrow morning at 9.
Writing, the Reardon Memoirs.
Ed Reardon is revisiting past glories.
If old Freddie Pendleton hadn't fallen over drunk and broken his leg on the big ashtray, I would never have got on the writing team for Danger Mouse.
All the highs.
Do you know Ken Loach?
I think we may have been on the same blacklist at one time.
And the lows.
He got drunk and fell asleep on Petra's grave in the Blue Peter Garden.
The new series of Ed Reardon's Week, starring Christopher Douglas.
There you are, Elgar. I've got the earth to save.
Tuesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now, though, for the last time this series, Sue Perkins explores the weird, wonderful and slightly yucky natural world in Nature Table.
Hello, I'm Sue Perkins and welcome to Nature Table. The natural world, well, it's a funny old thing. For example, did you know that a housefly buzzes in the key of F? Although if you ask him to do a version of Fast Car, he will insist that you provide an acoustic guitar. In the wild, female lions do 90% of the hunting. And they still get paid 20% less for it. Typical. We're coming to you today from ZSL London Zoo. At the entrance to the zoo is a statue of one of its most famous residents, Guy the Gorilla. Either that or someone has done a really bad David Attenborough and they're just styling it out. We may not have a studio audience with us, but with me to poke and prod at today's offerings is comedian Felicity Ward. And bringing items to place on the table like an avant-garde harvest festival, we've got marine biologist and author Dr. Helen Scales and senior curator for Diptera and Siphonaptera at the British Museum. Ooh, I know I've pronounced that wrong. Dr. Erica McAllister. Welcome, everybody. Always a big hearty welcome back to the show, to you, Felicity. Now, growing up in Australia, you must have had some near scrapes with some dangerous critters.
I've had some scrapes. The one that I think of from a very young age is I was about 6 or 7 and we were going for a bushwalk, a couple of my friends and one of their parents, and one of them got bitten by a snake. What happened was his mum sort of rushed forward and went, quick, clear the space. And then she ripped off her shirt and she was just in a bra and she sort of tied it as a tourniquet. And I was very uncomfortable with my sexuality at that time. And I thought, he's 8, let him go. He's had a good life. I don't want to see your tits. That's sort of how I felt.
So for you, the dangerous scrape was having to be in close proximity to someone's mum's boobs.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a similar thing at Crystal Palace swimming pool when I was at a very young age.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The pool is fraught with women
Mrs.
like
Kyle's
that.
Enormous bosom suddenly mm-hmm. descended on me. And I didn't want them near me. And
why?
I didn't know why. Well, we were in the changing room and she just leant over to say, come on, you know, give yourself a good towel.
Yeah.
And it was basically like being motorboated by, at the time yes. it felt like a geriatric. And it's very scarring. Helen, welcome back to Nature Table. Now, if you could pick an animal to come back as, what animal would you pick?
I think I would pick an octopus.
For why?
Well, there's lots of reasons, really. But maybe mostly I want to know what it feels like. To have half of my brains in my arms and to have 8 arms. And I want to know, is it possible for me to delegate my thinking to my arms?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I think it would be quite cool. I mean, I also like the idea of if I don't really like what one of my arms is thinking about, I could just cut it off and grow a new one and see what the new one has to think about instead.
Yeah. All those days where you go, I just wish I could have a day without my head.
Yes.
You could do that, but it would be your hand.
Exactly. And you could grow a new one, as I say, if you don't really like it.
I mean,
I don't know how long it would take, but...
It doesn't matter to get rid of persistent negative thoughts. I'd be happy to do that.
It sounds better than cognitive behavioural therapy, and I've done it a few times. In fact, I feel resentful that I'm human and not octopus now.
All right. Erica, again, welcome back. Same question for you. You could be... Well, obviously, the octopus is now taken.
Yeah.
Given that to Dr.
Helen. I'm sorry about that.
I feel that you've done a really sensible thing. Yours has gone all about, like, thinking and very cerebral. Mine was to come back as a robber fly because then I'd be really nasty. And I just like the idea of coming back as one of the most badass predators that no one thinks about. So they're tiny little flies, but they're all venomous. And they've got unique venoms to science. So we've now been looking at their venoms and they have about 30 new venoms. But they're great. And they've been filmed in America attacking hummingbirds. And
wow.
Killing. Yeah, it's great. I mean, they're proper thug flies. They come along, they grab their prey, they paralyze them, and then they suck their insides out and then drop them.
You'd think that would be a Dracula fly, not a robber fly. A robber fly
Well, the Americans call them assassin flies, which kind of makes a little bit more sense.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
We're British and we're like, no,
How many
just
animals do you know that come in, burglarise your home, and then basically suck your innards out?
Well, I'm just saying, it's a way forward.
So, all right, come on. I've welcomed you in. You're marvellous. Let's get this show and tell on. Helen, first of all, what have you brought to place on the nature table?
I have brought a seahorse. It's a dead one, not a live one, unfortunately, but it is.
Well, it's in a box, so I'm glad that
it's dead.
It's
in a box.
Poorly housed and alive.
And the fact is, hopefully you can see, that it does still look really beautiful, even though it's dead. And I really think that this is one of the reasons why so many people believe that seahorses have magical powers, that they're these kind of mystical beasts. I mean, look at it. It looks like a baby dragon. It's so delicate and tiny. This one, I should say, is it's a few centimetres long. It's a dwarf seahorse. It comes from the Caribbean. It's got a beautiful curling tail. It's got all its little features are there.
Even alive, it looks like a moving fossil.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and it's such a confusing animal. I mean, people for a long time had no idea what these were. I mean, they thought they were insects, possibly a weird type of shrimp, and that's because they have this body armour on the outside. It's kind of like an exoskeleton, like an insect, and that's what's holding it together and keeping it in its beautiful shape. But people, like, honestly believe that, like, what I have in my hand is like a lucky charm or like a magic talisman that will bring me luck and bring me good fortune. In Asia, people will hold them during childbirth because they think that that will help things along. It goes back and back that the Romans thought that seahorses could make their hair grow back. It was a good treatment for baldness.
Well, if you sewed them to your scalp, you could have...
Like Medusa.
That would be pretty cool.
I mean, it's a pointed toupee, but you could see, you know.
And how did... how and why, I suppose, did it develop that the males actually birth the young? It's a sort of an evolutionary anomaly, isn't it?
It really is. They're the only animals we know in which it's genuinely the males that that look after the unborn young. There's some really recent science showing that they actually do. Because we weren't quite sure, were they just holding onto the eggs in their belly pouches and just kind of letting them grow? But no, they're actually providing nutrients and oxygen. So they really are, it's genuine kind of gestation inside their bodies.
Right.
But I should say, this all happens, the female and the male come together and have this beautiful mating dance. And seahorse, many species are quite faithful to each other and they will keep mating with the same one throughout their lifetimes. And so they have this, they have sort of dance and sort of chirp together, and then the female will put her eggs straight into the male's pouch. He then emits his sperm into the water, which is quite strange, and then he sucks them back into his pouch. Just the way he's wired up is sort of not quite
that's
right.
It's evolutionary weirdness, because you think he could just fire it into the pouch.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of shows us that it evolved through steps.
Tell me what a seahorse hotel is. What is that?
Oh, yes. So in Sydney, in Australia, in the harbour, some people have been building seahorse hotels.
That's incredible, right?
Which is pretty cool. Well, the reason they need to is because their natural habitat has been decimated by at least 50%. These sort of seaweedy habitats that they need to live in have been destroyed by
incredible
fishing and stuff. And so what they need is somewhere to hide. Because the thing about a seahorse is they don't swim very fast and they need things to hold on to with their beautiful little monkey tails. It's like they need to hold on to stuff. Like, that's a kind of a really important part of being a seahorse.
So they'll be holding seaweed or something that's coming up from the ocean bed, and the tails will latch onto that, and that'll be a kind of mooring mechanism.
Exactly.
They're weighing anchor.
Exactly. So whether it's coral or seaweed, and these seahorse hotels, they're basically actually just kind of chicken wire kind of wrapped around, and then the seaweed comes and it settles on those wires, and the seahorses move in, and they've got a nice safe place to hold on, and apparently they love it, and the seahorses are moving in, they're finding partners,
they're visiting from other parts of the country, the tourism is going mad in the seahorse industry.
You're going to need seahorse bars, you need some infrastructure, love, because a hotel's just not enough without the essential services.
Absolutely.
Seahorses aren't the only animals that defy gender norms, of course. There are plenty of other creatures doing their very best to smash the patriarchy too. So it's time to play my favourite game, Binary Schminery. Binary Schminery. Right, I'm going to give you some facts about animals who defy gender norms, and you can tell me if they're true or just something that you might read on Facebook. Slipper-shell snails, known as crepidula, transition from male to female whenever a female in the group dies. True or false?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true.
Is this true?
I'll go true.
I saw Helen nodding fervently, so I will also say yes.
Helen is right, as are the rest of you. Yes, it's called sequential hermaphrodism. True or false, female rhesus monkeys are disinterested in sex to the point they only allow it once a year.
I'm going to say true.
True?
Do you know, I'm going to go opposite just because I know nothing.
Right, it's false, because female rhesus monkeys have incredibly high sex drives. The females objectify the males, chase them, and do pretty much everything else apart from actually forcing them. And I'm just saying, when will Planet of the Apes get the all-female reboot we've been dreaming of? Just putting it out there. True or false, 40% of male March Harrier birds have evolved to resemble their female counterparts. That's the Marsh Harrier.
I know this happens a lot in beetles.
Does it?
Stag beetle, you get the dominant male that everyone recognises with the big horns, but you also get a gamma male who looks like a female and basically covers himself with essence of female. So he goes
into
the little... Yeah, so he goes into the harem, has sex with the dominant male. Dominant male goes off and has his post-coital cigarette, and then he goes and sleeps with all the women.
That is brilliant. And not too dissimilar from the March Harrier, because the males assume a female appearance to basically, so they can go under the radar.
Yeah.
It stops them being attacked by the alpha male, as you say. I'm not sure if they then go on to... I mean, that's incredible. Surreptitious bedroom antics. Mm. It's amazing. That's the end of our game, Binary Shminery. We may come back to it another time. Who knows? I mean, it's got a catchy title.
It does. It rhymes.
But thank you, Helen, because I think on behalf of all of us, I can say the message from you is be more seahorse, and I love that. Erica, what have you bought for our nature table? It's going to be gross. I know it.
Ah, thanks. Yes, probably. Now, I've kind of cheated because I haven't brought one animal. I brought a stage.
A stage? This sounds awful.
I brought a life stage. So I'm bringing the maggot stage of a fly. Generally, you go from an egg, a larvae, to a pupa, to an adult. And everyone knows about the adult stage. That's the bit that flies around predominantly and everyone gets in. But it's the maggot stage, the larval stage, that is the more fun in some ways, because that's the eating stage. I mean, maggots are fantastic. And not only are they themselves fantastic, they're munching machines, but they're really, really useful to us.
Why?
Because they are the first to turn up at the scene, as it were.
So they're nature's biodegraders, I suppose.
They are probably, arguably, some of the most important decomposers on the planet. It's something ridiculous, like I was working out defecation rates, as you do, of all animals on the planet. I mean, it's an extraordinary how many tons of feces get defecated every day.
I mean, lockdown was hard for lots of us, but it sounds like it's hit you particularly hard. Yeah. If that's a wormhole that I didn't explore.
Especially with the loo paper crisis. It's really a really terrible issue.
I really don't think lockdown's had an impact on that, but I like that.
As a planet, we're frantic defecators.
Yeah, and we're also decomposing bodies everywhere.
What do you mean everywhere?
Everywhere. Can you imagine if we didn't get rid of all the bodies dying everywhere? But there's also bad death, as in humans killing each other. And which is why little maggots, we use them as detectives.
Ah, now this is the body farm, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which I believe was featured in, I think I saw a CSI. I mean, it's so rarely on, isn't it, CSI? You really, really have to, once in a blue moon will it cross your eyes. But it's extraordinary because you can work out through the development of insects within a body how long it's been dead for.
Yeah. So we've been doing this for 800 years. Using insects to determine, like, when death occurred and who the murderer was. And one of the earliest examples is a Chinese medicine man. And he was wandering around and he came to this village and one of the workers on the land had got his machete and killed another worker on the land. And so all of them came out of the village and said, please help us solve the crime. And so he got them all out and he got all their machetes and they're all looking the same and all clean and wonderful and everything. And he said, OK, just stand there. And he made all these people stand there in front of their machetes. And then after about half an hour, because it's a really warm day, all the flies went to one machete.
Ooh.
So even though this guy cleaned all the blood off, he wasn't that good. He didn't realise these flies can sniff dead bodies from miles away. So if you were to commit a murder, just really do think about this.
So you're... it's MCSI, Maggot Crime Scene Investigation.
Correct, is exactly right.
I mean, that's a show that I would watch, actually.
I would watch it. I mean...
They've done every other incarnation.
This is true. They've done Miami. Once you've done Miami, it's only maggots to go,
turn to
really.
Maggots.
Is it true they do use maggots to clean wounds?
Yes, maggot debridement therapy. Okay, so it debrides your flesh.
So basically it's kind of cleaning the area, isn't it, of any sort of hanging flesh.
And maggots are amazing because not only do they get rid of the necrotic flesh, so the dead and dying flesh, which is a big problem nowadays, because type 2 diabetes, you having many ulcerating wounds, which are really hard to clean, maggots are one of the few things that actually get rid of it.
Are you telling me they do that now in modern medicine?
You get it on the NHS. And in fact, go and have a look at YouTube videos afterwards of a foot that's been maggot debrided and one that isn't. And it, the maggots release an enzyme that causes your skin to bind better.
It's spotless. It's like one of those advertisements for like vacuum cleaners. And you see...
the before or after.
Yeah, what the regular Hoover will do, and then this particular brand. I mean, you get a maggot on an arm, mate.
Yeah.
You could eat off it.
Thank you, Erica, for sharing your weird maggots. Whenever I come to the zoo, I love to have a chat with the many staff and experts here, mainly to see if they can get me a discount in the gift shop, but also to absorb their incredible knowledge. But mainly the gift shop thing is also yes, important. We're going to go now to Jess Courtney-Jones. Welcome back, Jess. What are you going to share with us today?
I'm going to be talking about owls, because they're beautiful and I love them very loads.
I love owls.
They're amazing.
Oh, I love them. They're like my spirit animal.
They're so beautiful. They're amazing. So I've brought some feathers here. So the big ones here are actually from Max, our Eurasian Eagle Owl.
I love those.
Oh, he's beautiful. He's 27 years old. He weighs 2.5 kilos, which is about 5.5 pounds.
Baba.
He's lovely. He's very, very sweet. Very close to my heart. But one thing that I just wanted to talk about, because we always get asked this a lot when we're doing our demonstrations and talking about owls, is unfortunately, well, most of you probably would have heard about the wise old owl.
Mm.
They're not wise at all.
Are they really dumb?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm really sorry.
No, I love a dumb animal. I love a dumb child, and I love a dumb animal.
So when they're talking about a parliament of owls... It really is.
It's accurate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
But they're just really, really good at being owls. And that's the main thing.
So they look like cats who've hit a window, don't they?
Yes.
I once had a double take off a barn owl. I'm not joking. It was the funniest thing. I had to lie down in a field for 20 minutes. I was laughing so much. It was flying. It literally looked at me. It looked at whether... and it just stayed flying. It was so perfectly timed. I absolutely love them. And it's interesting, a friend of mine has got a door knocker with an owl on it, and had some friends staying, I think, from Morocco, and they said, why is this stupid bird on your... So I think other cultures perhaps don't have that wise owl mythology, recognise that the bird is a bit of an idiot.
And it's really not their fault. It's because, so if we take Max, for example, the Eurasian Eagle Owl, his brain is probably about the same size as a Malteser.
Wow.
But it's because...
Delicious.
It's because his eyes are so big. So his eyes actually take up 70% of his skull. So there's not much room there for a brain.
So what's going on? Just la, 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 la.
Yeah,
mouse.
Basically. Yeah.
The end.
100%. They do something called sit and wait predation. So they'll just sit and they'll just wait for the food to come to them, and they'll be sitting there in a tree and be like, oh, mouse, and then they fly down.
They're quite lazy, aren't they? This I do know.
They're very, I think they're like little ninjas, really. If you have a really close look at these feathers, on the edges of the feathers, they actually are serrated, which means that as they're flying, they cut through the air, reducing the air turbulence, meaning that they can fly completely silently. So literally the prey won't even know that they're there, sitting there.
Are their eyes so big because they're so dumb that they're just shocked by everything that's happening in front of them?
How far can it see? Is it sparrowhawk type level?
It is, yeah. So we basically will say to the public when we're doing our demonstrations that when they're up flying probably like a few metres, they would be able, in the sky, they'd be able to read like the fine print on a newspaper. It's that good, their eyesight.
Wouldn't matter to understand it because they've got the brain the size of a
Malteser. Exactly.
Only they could know what's going on.
It's not editorial, is it? So, yeah.
Most people think as well that their heads turn all the way around. They don't, because it'd fall off. So their heads can actually turn.
Smart move.
It's smart, yeah. It turns 270 in both directions.
Same as some flies.
Same, there you go. But I don't know if this is true about flies, but the owls, they can't move their eyeballs, which is why they always look like they're shocked, because their eyes are so big that they have to sort of be fixed into place.
Like sort of Nicole Kidman, late stage Nicole Kidman.
Exactly like that.
She's still alive.
No, but I mean, she's gone full circular eye now.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. I've only just realised there's actually quite a lot of in common between seahorses and owls, because seahorses are also sit and wait predators.
Oh, there we go.
Maybe not quite so scary as an owl. Yeah. And they can also move their heads around. They're the only fish with a neck. So they can
of course
really?
They do.
Yes.
Yeah.
They've got a neck.
Mm-hmm. No other fish do.
They're incredible. That's a good tying in. You've done my job for me. For that reason, for many others as well, I'm resigning. Just like a cheap relative at a wedding buffet, let's barge our way back to the table with big thanks to Jess. Right, Helen, what else have you brought?
Oh, I've got this, which I love this. This is an Antarctic Yeti crab.
Oh, hello. Come on.
And it's actually, well, it's one of six species. They were first discovered in 2005. And the first Yeti crabs, these guys live on hydrothermal vents, otherwise known as black smokers. These very deep, very toxic, very extraordinarily extreme parts of the deep sea. Yeti crabs have great big long arms covered in fur, hence Yeti crab. They look a bit like you might imagine what a Yeti looks like.
Crab.
And then this one was found in 2010 in Antarctica, the first time anyone had explored hydrothermal vents in Antarctica. Only these guys don't have hairy arms, they have a hairy chest. So actually these have a different nickname. These ones were nicknamed the Hoff crab after David Hasselhoff.
Very surprising they didn't go for the Selick.
They went through the different ideas. They were like,
but the Selick is a moustache. That's the moustachioed crab, isn't it?
But his chest too.
Yeah. You're
like,
right.
Do you think of Hoff? I don't think of Hoff having a hairy chest.
I don't think
chest.
Of Hoff at all, but now I'm forced to.
I think of him as
smooth.
And a couple
smooth
of hairs. I don't think of him like a rug. And I love a rug.
I think of Connery, the late great Connery.
Yes,
that was on. That was a possibility, but they went with Hoff. The really bizarre thing about their hairy chests and arms is that that's how they get their food. So these things live on black smokers, which is like a mile and a half down under the waves. These things throw out fluids at like 380 degrees centigrade. There's no oxygen, it's full of toxins, it's just a horrible place to be, and yet there's animal life flourishing on hydrothermal vents, including the delightful Yeti crabs. They survive by eating the bacteria that grows in their fur, so on their chest or on their arms. And you might have noticed, well, this little one I've got here is a female, and she's not that big, so she's like, what, a couple of centimetres across? Mm, about the size of my
seahorse.
She's like
a 50b piece, isn't she? A bit small.
Yeah. The males grow bigger, and that's because they will go closer to these chimneys, because this is where they're getting their food from. So these bacteria that are growing in their fur are chemosynthetic, which means they have this whole other way of getting food than the way that we do out here on land. Everything basically on land is photosynthesis. Chemosynthesis is a dark alternative. They're using mainly hydrogen sulfide methane as a source of energy. So these bacteria have like a mechanism whereby, instead of using sunlight, they use chemicals.
Look, I'm just going to say it because I'm a simpleton. Are the males eating farts? What are we... I'm not... They are.
Well, the bacteria that they eat are, eating the farts.
Okay, no. Look, somebody had to say it. We're saying methane. There's a lot of people at home that are just saying, are they eating farts? Just say it.
It's pretty much, a fart-powered ecosystem. That's what's so cool about these hydrothermal vents, is that when they were first discovered in the 70s, it was geologists who went first down to look at hydrothermal vents, and they weren't expecting anything to be alive down there. They just thought it was geology
happening. At least of all, a fart-eating bearded crab.
And then there they are. There are these six-foot tube worms. There are, like, clams the size of dinner plates. And then later on, we find things like Yeti crabs. And it's just, we're finding more stuff all the time on these crazy places where no one was expecting anything.
I love that. I love the idea that they're sort of coasting these sort of thermals and sort of eating bacteria off their big chest hair, sort of ruggy chests. It's they're a fabulous animal.
It's very macho, isn't it? It's
very,
very butch, the whole thing.
It is. It's rugged.
It is rugged.
Yeah, eat my fart.
Eat my fart.
Just have, thanks.
Got a rug on my chest.
Yeah.
Climbing the pipes, you know.
It's pretty. I like them, though. And what I love as well is that the deep ocean is one, as you say, still yet to be fully mapped and charted. Erica, what else have you brought to add to our now, I have to say, positively groaning nature table? We've got flies, we've got owls, we've got seahorses, we've got everything.
Well, I'm going to a fly that migrates, and it's called Episurfers balteatus, which is the marmalade hoverfly to you lot, because apparently it looks like chunky marmalade. It doesn't.
Tasty.
What they've just done is published a little study, and they found out every year hundreds of millions of this species of hoverfly turn up in the UK. So they migrate from North Africa and across Europe and end up in the UK. And this Episurfers balteatus, along with another really common migrator, Eupioides, which is another hoverfly, basically do exactly the same work as the honeybees in the UK. So everybody goes on about the amazing honeybees, and I'm
not... Yeah, because the honeybees got fur, and that we know now that that makes them nice.
Yeah, exactly. But these are quite hairy as well, just saying.
Don't like them.
These are not only... Because baby honeybees, what do baby honeybees do?
Buzz.
Nothing. Nothing.
They are just babies. There. Give them a break.
No.
What is this, a Victorian workhouse?
Well, let them alone. That's not fair, because baby flies, as we know, the maggots, the larvae, are out there doing things already.
More fool them.
Well, you say that, but actually they're really, really important because they do that. Because these larvae eat aphids. So hundreds of millions of hoverflies, woo, coming across. They're joining our local hoverflies. So it's like the, I know.
Let's.
Yeah, I imagine it's this little party with all the, like, the English hoverflies going, oh, hello, the Italians have turned up. And in fact,
too exotic.
They do actually breed better with the foreigners, which is great. And it's a good example.
Is it good that you don't get xenophobic flies?
No, I like the fact it's a good example of Europe working together.
I was going to say, I'm surprised the Sun haven't run an article on these flies.
Well,
coming here from North Africa.
And doing lots of good work.
You know, not getting any
good. Farage gets a tip off.
Exactly.
And basically, their larvae, they eat aphids, which are the white fly. Basically, these little aphids destroy our crops. They could just munch their way through. So in a wheat field, there's loads of aphids. These hoverflies, they've come over here, they've mated with the ladies, they've had lots of fun, they've had lots of babies. Now these maggots, the larvae of the hoverfly, before they get to an adult, they can eat up to 400 aphids. So 20% of crop protection in wheat fields is done by this hoverfly larvae. That means that on average, they destroy or they eat 6 trillion aphids every season. So much we have to thank on our agro ecosystem by these migrant workers coming over here and looking after things.
You did classic need to convince me.
It's a classic migrant tale.
It is.
Yeah.
They come looking for a better life and they enrich the communities that they
And one of the amazing thing is that we export more back. So there's more larvae, more of the adults that migrate back across Europe. Now, this migrating thing, again, is a really good conservation story. Because they're such high flyers, they're so high up, they can see pockets of vegetation that can be quite isolated, and they're able to go down and pollinate those plants.
So they're pollinators as well as pesticides?
Yeah, and the adults are pollinators.
So this is great because of the bee, as you say, which is much loved, and we know that the bees, we have problems with hive collapse and stuff, and because of monoculture, there's fewer, blah, blah, blah. But if the worst happens, and God only knows, I hope it doesn't, then some of that work of pollination could be taken over.
It's already there. We are now, because we focus so much on the charismatic insects, the bees.
Never heard a bee be called charismatic, but I like
it. They are a charming little insect, though.
And bees also, we've now looked at honeybees, that they often leave signatures behind that tell other insects to back off.
Well, like Zorro. What, their own signatures? I mean, how narcissistic.
Maybe they think they're going to be famous one day.
Yeah, practicing their signature.
Yeah.
Erica, thank you, though, for importantly reminding us of the job that it does. I think it's really important. It's not, bees can't take all the credit, is what we've learned from that. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. But there is just enough time for me to thank my beloved guests and hospitality and the knowledge of the staff here at ZSL London Zoo. I'm off to test whether elephants truly can never forget by asking them where the hell I left my car keys. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Nature Table was hosted by me, Sue Perkins, and featured Dr. Helen Scales, Dr. Erica McAllister, and Felicity Ward. It was written by Kat Sadler, Catherine Brinkworth, and John Hunter. The researcher was Catherine Beasley. The music was by Ben Mirren, and the producer was Simon Nichols. This was a BBC Studios production.
This is Radio 4 now, if you're feeling bereft of the cricket today.
A huge summer of live cricket is upon us, and the Test Match Special podcast brings you the best insight and analysis from the TMS team.
That first over.